Cyclo word, between meal bites. Help us out.
Johnny laughed. If that was all the problems they had, life would be a basking in the sun. He sat down in a chair and began to eat the snack. Tsung, after setting up a small table, was back to bobbing again. What's he bowing about? Said Johnny. The chief waved his hand, and Johnny saw that a fourth view screen had been installed, making two for the conference room.
He's been in here all the time you were on that platform, working a coordinator half to death, translating. They've got disks of everything that went on. The second screen was so they could see both you and the emissaries. I looked in here a time or two.
Mr. Tsung was volubly interrupting him. The chief translated.
He wants you to know that you are the fastest pupil he has ever seen. He says, if you had been an imperial prince of China and his family had still been chamberlains and not exiled, China would still be there.
Johnny laughed and would have acknowledged with a return compliment, but Mr. Tsung was talking very fast and drawing something from his sleeve.
He wants something, said the chief. He wants you to put your chop on this paper. That is, your signature.
He was unfolding it. It was a considerable expanse of Chinese characters. The chief raised his eyebrows and translated the sense of it for Johnny.
This says that you approved the cancellation of exile of his family from the imperial court, and that you recommend its reinstatement as chamberlains to the principal government of this planet and yourself.
I'm not a member of the government, said Johnny.
He knows all that. But he wants your chop on it. I warn you that he has two brothers and several relatives. They are all educated in diplomacy and such. Oh, he tells me there's a second paper here. Yes, this one restores their rank as mandarins of the blue button. Lets them wear a round cap with a blue button on top. Noblemen, actually. It's valid. They are noblemen.
But I'm not, began Johnny. Mr. Tsung sang off into half a dozen trills of protest.
He says you don't know what you are. Put your chop on these and he'll do the rest.
Johnny said, but I have no authority. The war isn't over yet. Not by a long ways.
He says wars are wars and diplomats are diplomats, and there is no point in the game when it ends. I'd sign them if I were you, Lord Johnny. They're all studying Cyclo and English. It's his chance to attain an 1,100-year-old goal. I'll read these word for word for you.
Well, Johnny felt they might not have made it without Mr. Tsung, so he was given a brush and he signed them, and Chief Chong Wan witnessed them. Mr. Tsung reverently folded the pieces of paper into a cover of gold brocade and laid them away like they were crown jewels. Oh, yes, said Johnny as he left. One more thing. Tell him how much I enjoyed that tale about the dragon who ate the moon. Chapter 28 1 Cyclo, the home planet of 200,000 worlds, the center of an empire that had ruled and ruined 16 universes over a period of 302,000 years. Cyclo, that had been the cause of man's destruction. What had happened to its empire, if anything? What had happened to Cyclo? And if it still existed, what did it plan? Was it a danger or not? For a grueling and turbulent year, they had wondered. It lay like a nagging barb under their thoughts. Now they were going to find out. Pale light lit the bowl. The metal of the platform shone dully. Not a motor to be heard in the sky. The stars were bright above. Angus and Johnny looked at each other. Now they would know. First, said Johnny, we will inspect mine sites and see what transshipment rigs are active. Perhaps there is some indicator somewhere that would alert them to this. We will be cautious, not get too close to anything. The coordinate book told them of a transshipment rig at Luzite, a Cyclo mining world without population other than Cyclo miners. It was a large planet, but distant from Cyclo. They put the new gyro cage down, put a picto recorder in the armored case, calculated the coordinates for a point 40 miles from the Luzite transshipment site, punched the console buttons, and fired. The wires hummed. The cage came back. There was a slight recoil. Johnny put the disc in the atmosphere projector that still stood there. He pressed the button. For a moment, both he and Angus thought they must have miscalculated and shot a mine instead. 40 miles was a long way off for detail, and Johnny adjusted and recentered the scene before them. It was a hole, but not a mine. There stood a transshipment pole at a drunken angle. But it was otherwise just a hole in the planet's surface, no trace even of compound domes. Johnny wondered whether they had different compound layouts on different planets. Perhaps that Luzite platform had been miles from anything else. Still, the Cyclos were demons for standard layouts. Usually, the whole central administration of the planet was at the transshipment rig. For there was where the ore came from all over the planet. There was where the books were kept, where the main shops existed, where the top executives were. Just that hole. It was pretty big, but a hole is a hole. They chose another firing site, Mercogran, in the fifth universe. It was shown as a planet 5 times the size of Earth, but of less density. They fired and recalled the gyro cage. When Johnny turned the projector on, they saw at once they had something different. They had to widen the view on the projector to see better. Mercogran had been close to a mountain range, and avalanches had apparently come down. They would have covered much of the space of any compound. Johnny brought the view in closer. There, at the lower right, the inverted bowl of a compound dome. It was lying like a broken soup plate. There was a transshipment pole and attached charred wires sitting in the middle of it, but nothing else. So far, no tight conclusion could be reached beyond the fact that those central compounds and transshipment rigs were certainly no longer working. At random, they took another planet, Breloton. It was an inhabited planet, another reference told them, with a population of its own, governed by a Cyclo regency, enduring such rule for 60,000 years. They calculated the coordinates for a spot 40 miles from the transshipment rig and fired the gyro cage. They were not prepared for what they got. The atmosphere image showed a city. The transshipment rig there had apparently been on a raised plateau in the center of town. Buildings that once must have been massive were blown to bits. They made a spreading pattern that radiated out from the plateau. Buildings that must have been 2,000 feet high in a city that must have held 1 million beings or more had fallen outward like dominoes. The remains of the rig were plain. The platform was a hole. The poles were all leaning outward. The compound domes had lain under the edge of the plateau and had been lifted by concussion and blown away, leaving the familiar underground layout plain in view. Bringing the compound in closer, one could see what must be a year's growth of grass in crevices. There was no sign of life. Johnny went back and sat down and thought. He asked Angus to find some views the air cover had taken at the Purgatoire River, views of the American compound. Angus got them, and Johnny looked at them. The hole where the platform had been, the outward lean of the poles that still stood, the blasted city 50 or more miles away. "I know what happened," said Johnny. "We could go on looking at cycloplanets all night and get the same answer. Give me that computer. We're going to look at Cyclo on day 92 last year." Light. It traveled approximately 5,869,713,600,000 miles a year. The light which came from Cyclo on that hour and date was still traveling in space. They would get just ahead of it, and with a picto recorder from a star drone set for 6 trillion times magnification, they would look at Cyclo at the instant it occurred. Whatever had occurred. It had been just a few days ago, over a year ago. Choose the sidereal angle to aim the scope. Avoid nearby heavenly bodies so that the cage would not be influenced by gravity and would stay there for 2 or 3 minutes. No, let's be brave and put it there for 15 minutes and hope it doesn't move and we get it back. It took a while to set up. They had to readjust magnification, tune in heat sensors, and blind them to other bodies. Calculate seconds. They fired the cage. The wires hummed in holding for the long required time. They called the cage back. It arrived. It was a little misplaced on the platform.
Johnny would have touched it in his eagerness, but Angus grabbed his hand. It would be cold enough for the metal to take one's skin off. They had to wait and let it warm up, for if they opened it cold, they might warp a disc with the abrupt temperature shift. It was like teasing a thirsty man by withholding a water skin from him. Finally, they projected it. What a brilliant picture! They had thought it might be fuzzy, such as you get with heat waves. But the light that had traveled for over a year was crystal clear and straight. There was the imperial city of Cyclo. Circular tram rails, streets down from its cliffs like conveyor belts. They even carried the idea of mining into their city design. Huge, bustling Cyclo. The center of power of the universes. The hub of the great, cruel claw that raked the bones from planets and peoples everywhere. There was the 302,000-year-old monster itself, spread out in its sadistic and ugly might. Neither Johnny nor Angus had ever seen a live city of that size before. 100 million population? 1 billion? Not the planet, just the city above the lower plain. Look at the trams. Rails that ran in circular spirals. Cars that looked for all the world like mine cars, but full of people. Mobs in the streets. Mobs? Not riots, just cyclos. You ever see so many beings? Even in such a tiny size, one could see mobs. They were daunted. They compared it to their own towns, even to their own ruined cities. These didn't measure up to it at all. What arrogance to attack anything like that. They were so awestruck and impressed, they hadn't even been looking at the transshipment rig of Cyclo. They missed the beginning and had to track back. They adjusted the projector lens and position to get the transshipment platform of Cyclo more centered and enlarged. And then they saw the whole sequence, just as it had occurred right after Johnny and Windsplitter had raced across the Earth platform. First, there were the Cyclo workers racing out to leave the platform clear for the incoming semi-annual from Earth. There were flatbeds lined up to receive coffins and personnel. There was the first shimmer of arrival of the Cyclos Johnny and Windsplitter had knocked down. Then a small puff. There were the Cyclo workmen flinching back. A force screen had gone on. A dome over the platform had closed instantly to contain that small explosion. It could not have been an atmosphere armor cable, some sort of shimmering, sparkling screen, transparent, but very much there. Trucks had time to start up before anything else occurred. One huge emergency truck had lunged nearer the platform, evidently to handle the minor blast. A whole minute went by. Then the first lethal coffin exploded. A big planet-buster nuclear bomb nestled into a bed of dirty mines. The force screen held. The Holocaust was contained. The boiling, ferocious blast had not even bulged the screen. Then another shock as the second coffined planet buster went off. The screen held. Good Lord, what technology to build a screen like that. What power it must take to hold it. Another shock inside that dome. The third planet buster. It and all its ancient, very dirty atomic bombs. The screen held. Cyclos were racing toward it from far off. Those near the platform were flattened by concussion transmitting through the screen. The fourth contained bomb went off. The screen still held. But the transmitted concussion had hurled the emergency truck backward. Nearby buildings lost their glass. The ground was shaking as though hit by gigantic earthquakes. A nearby building suddenly dropped downward as though sucked from below. Other buildings began to go the same way. The fifth bomb went off. And seen in slow motion, first narrowly, then more broadly, the entire scene went into a churning, boiling mass of atomic fire. No, something more. Molten, flaming fire was erupting in spots all over the plain. They widened the angle quickly. The whole imperial city of Cyclo was sinking, and all about it sprayed up rolling oceans of molten fire.
The circular trams, the mobs, the buildings, and even the towering cliffs were drowning in a tumult of liquid yellow-green flame. They hastily widened the view, and they saw the entire planet of Cyclo turn into a radioactive sun. The recording ended. They sat limp.
"My God," said Angus.
Johnny felt a little sick. Cyclos or not, he had just watched the end product of all their planning and risk a year ago, and he was hit with a feeling of guilt. It was not easy to take responsibility for that much destruction. He had thought the bombs would wipe out the company headquarters and perhaps the Imperial City, but they had created a new sun.
"What happened?" said Angus.
Johnny looked at his feet.
"I pulled 10 tabs out of those coffins. We didn't want to set a time fuse and then have them go off on Earth. We knew the bombs were a bit contaminated. Had radiation leaks. They were old, and their cases were old. We handled them in radiation suits."
He made a dropping gesture with his hand. "In the fight, I dropped the fuse tabs on the platform. I forgot them. They must have been slightly radioactive, and when they hit the Cyclo platform, they made a small puff of explosion. They are what caused the minor recoil last year. They triggered the force screen on Cyclo that the Chamcos mentioned, and that force screen was good enough and strong enough to contain the blasts. I read in a book Char had that the crust of Cyclo is riddled with abandoned mine shafts and tunnels, a complete sieve. They call it semi-core mining. The blasts went down. One after another, they pounded deeper and deeper toward the molten core of Cyclo. The fifth explosion penetrated the core. The next 5 exploded in that. I think all a nuclear weapon does is stimulate a chain reaction into existence. And in addition to blowing out the planet crust, the fusion continued. And is probably still going on and may well go on for millions of years. Cyclo is no longer a planet. It's a flaming sun."
Angus nodded.
"And all the transshipment rigs in the whole Cyclo Empire, keeping schedule, not knowing about it, fired into that radioactive sun and blew themselves to bits?"
Johnny nodded, a bit spent. "Just like we did in Denver a year later." He shuddered. "Turl fired himself into a holocaust. Poor Turl." That's what it took to yank Angus out of it.
"Poor Turl! After all the rotten things the demon did? Johnny, I sometimes wonder about you. You can be cool as ice, and then all of a sudden you come out with something like, 'Poor Turl.'"
"It would be an awful way to die," said Johnny. Angus straightened up.
"Well," he said, just like he had popped out of a dive in the lake, "Cyclo is gone. The Empire is gone. And that's one thing we don't have to worry about anymore. Good riddance."
2. Despite emotional reactions, Johnny had been raised a hunter. His had been a life in the mountains, much of it spent alone on trails where pumas and grizzlies and wolves could lurk. There were times when you could feel a planning predator behind you, watching for a false move, concentrated on intentions of its own. For the last 15 seconds, he had had that feeling. Danger. He spun about, tensed for action. The small gray man behind him said, "Oh, didn't you know?" Johnny let his hand fall away from his gun butt. The small gray man appeared not to have noticed.
"A lot adds up now that I didn't understand before. Yes, I fear Cyclo is gone. We knew that, of course. We weren't sure how."
Angus said,
"Are there any Cyclos left? Anywhere?"
The small gray man shook his head. The other small gray man, who had arrived by teleportation, had been lurking in the shadows. He came forward now.
"We checked it and checked it. Probes told us Cyclo was gone only a couple of weeks after it happened. We've had ships out everywhere."
The first small gray man had glanced at him. A cautionary glance? The other small gray man smoothly shifted what he was going to say.
"The transshipment rigs were all at mine site centrals or at Regency palaces. That was company custom. All their executive personnel and high-ranking officers on planets were quartered near the platforms. Pure laziness, really. So they wouldn't have far to walk and could get dispatches sooner. And the bulk of their breathe gas storage was also in the same area. The first word they got, they never went in much for space travel as such, since they had a monopoly on teleportation, and it wouldn't have gotten back to them soon enough anyway, was when they fired into Cyclo. We, of course, couldn't examine all universes, but knowing Cyclos, we are positive there are no transshipment rigs or central compounds or executives left. We ourselves gave it up over 5 months ago. The time limit would have been 6 months for breathe gas to last, and that expired 6 months ago. Johnny had been watching them carefully. These men were hiding something, and they wanted something. They were a threat. Deep down, he knew that. Their manner was easy. They were very pleasant and smooth, but their frankness was a pose. "How can you be sure," said Johnny, "that some cycloengineer didn't build a transshipment rig?" "Oh," said the second small gray man. "He would have fired straight to us at once if he avoided firing into Cyclo. The rig nearest us blew to bits, took half a city with it. Horrible. Just by a freak, I was out sailing with my family that day, miles away. However, our own offices are 15 levels underground." Was the original small gray man giving him a warning sign? In any case, he got interested in his pointed fingernails. Angus said, "I don't see any planets listed that have the same atmosphere as Cyclo. Are there any planets that have that breathe gas?" The two small gray men thought it over. Then the one who had come latest said, "Phobia. I don't think they'd list it." The two of them laughed about something. The original one said, "Excuse us. It's kind of a joke. The best-kept state secrets of Cyclo are all a kind of open book in our business. That they would omit listing Phobia is so typically Cyclo. It's where they exiled King Hack about 261,000 years ago. It's the only other planet in that system, and it is so much further out than Cyclo, you can't even see it from the home planet with an unaided eye. It is so cold, its atmosphere has liquefied and lies in lakes on the surface. They built a little dome there and exiled Hack and his fellow conspirators, and then got so scared he'd escape, they sent assassins in and killed them all. Typically Cyclo. They cut the whole thing out of their schoolbooks. Let's see your astrographic tables." He took them, looked a while, and then laughed and showed his companion. "Not there. An omitted planet right in their own system." In response to Johnny's look, the second one said, "No, not even any Cyclos there, and nothing going on there either. It's nothing but breathe gas ice, and very tiny anyway. As of a couple of weeks ago, probes showed it totally deserted. No, you can be certain that's the end of the Cyclos. I saw on scans I reviewed here that you have a very few still alive, but you didn't get them to build this." He patted the side of the console dragon. "For reasons best known to Cyclos, they'd kill themselves first." He shook his head. "There were a few alive, engineers in branch mine sites, and don't think one didn't try to persuade them. They're all dead now." Was the original one trying to turn the other one off? But the new one was a bit better dressed and appeared to be the superior of the other.
"I think," said the original, "that we really ought to get together for a formal conference. There are some things to take up."
"Ah," thought Johnny, "now we get to it." "I'm not a member of the government," he hedged. The newest arrival said, "We're aware of that, but you do enjoy its confidence. We were thinking that possibly if you and the two of us could have a talk, you might assist us to arrange a conference with your government."
"A talk about having a serious talk," said the other. Johnny had an inspiration. He recalled the first gray man had drunk Yarb tea. "I'll be having dinner in half an hour. If you can eat our food, I'd be pleased to have you join me." Oh, we eat anything, said the newest small gray man. Anything there is. We would be so pleased.
Half an hour it is, said Johnny. And he left to tell Chang Wan he had dinner guests after all. Now maybe he'd find out the threat that these two posed. He wasn't imagining it. These two were dangerous. 3. The small gray men could really eat. Johnny had been surprised at how well the chief had decorated the main room of the spare apartment. Colored paper lanterns with mine lamps in them had been hung about. 2 paintings, one of a tiger coming toward you in the snow, the other of a bird in flight, decorated the walls. Side tables for serving had been set up. The large center table where they sat even had a cloth on it. Mr. Tsung had insisted Johnny don a gold brocade tunic, after Johnny refused to wear a robe of green satin, and Johnny looked quite nice. Some very subdued but kind of squeaky music was coming from someplace. It and the click of dishes that Chief Chang Wan kept hauling in and the jaws of the small gray men were the only sounds. Johnny had tried to invite Angus, but he had said he had to keep an eye on that moon gyro. He had wanted Stormalong to come, but the pilot was dead tired and catching naps in the ops room. He had asked Chief Chang Wan and Mr. Tsung to also eat with them, but they said no, they had to serve. So just Johnny and the 2 small gray men had wound up as the diners. Johnny felt that this was a pity, for there was an awful lot of food. And Johnny, so far, had no one to talk to. The small gray men just ate, and ate, and ate. The dinner had begun with appetizers, egg rolls, barbecued loin ribs, and paper-wrapped chicken. These had been served in mounds, and had all been eaten up by the small gray men. Then various noodles had been served. Pancake noodles, yat ga mein, mun yi noodles, war wonton, beef lo mein, yi fu noodles, and gorn lo wonton, tubs of them. And the small gray men had eaten them all up. Large platters of chicken had been served. Almond chicken, cashew chicken, button mushroom chicken, and lychee chicken. And the small gray men had eaten all that up. Then there had been beef dishes, Mongolian beef, sautéed eggplant with beef, tomato beef, and chili pepper steak. And they had gotten around that. Massive platters of Peking duck, cooked in 3 ways, had, in its turn, disappeared down their gullets. They were working now on egg dishes. Chicken egg foo young, precious flower egg, and mushroom egg foo young. Johnny wondered where Chief Chang Wan had gotten all the ingredients, until he recalled that game had been plentiful, including lots of fowl in the lake, and that the Chinese had had time to plant and harvest gardens, using an area protected by the dam armor cable to keep the wild beasts out of it. He himself had not eaten very much. Mr. Tsung had had it relayed to him disparagingly that most of these dishes were southern Chinese cookery, and that true cookery had evolved in the north during the Qing Dynasty when his family took care of things. The Peking duck and Mongolian beef should get his main attention. Johnny had complied. It was pretty good food. Not as good, of course, as his Aunt Ellen's venison stew, but quite edible. The nurse had sent in word he was not to have any rice wine because of the sulfa, but that was fine. Johnny didn't much care for drinking anyway. These small gray men were eating the entire banquet that had been planned for 30 people. Where did they put it all? Johnny took the time to study them. Their skin was gray and kind of rough. Their eyes were a dull gray-blue, maybe like the sea, and had heavy lids. Their heads were round and hairless. Their noses took a sharp upturn just at the tip. The ears were a bit odd, reminded one more of gills than ears. They had 4 fingers and a thumb on each hand, though the nails were very pointed. They really looked quite like men. The main difference was their teeth. They had 2 rows of teeth, the second set just behind the first. Watching them eat so voraciously and hugely, Johnny tried to figure out what genetic lines such creatures might come from. They reminded him of something, and he sought to place it. Then he recalled a fish that a pilot who had been passing through Victoria had shown them. The pilot had been downed by fuel failure in the Indian Ocean and had ejected with a life raft. While waiting to be picked up, he was attacked by these fish. When he was rescued, they had shot one of the fish with a cannon and Picto recorded it. It had been pretty big. What had he called it? Johnny tried to think. They had looked it up in a man book. Ah, a shark. That had been the name. Yes, these small gray men had a similar skin, similar teeth. Maybe they were evolved from sharks that had become sentient. It finally came down to tea. It wasn't that the small gray men couldn't eat anymore. It was that Chief Chong Wan had run out of food. The tea was served, and the first small gray man asked, with just a trace of worry, whether this was Yarb tea. He was reassured that it was just plain green tea, a fact that seemed to bring relief. They sat back and smiled at Johnny. They said that this was the best dinner they had had in some time, maybe ever, and Chong Wan slid out to tell and please the cook. Under their gaze, Johnny thought to himself that now they were finished with all the food in sight, they were going to try to eat him. But no, that was vaporing. They were quite pleasant, really. Now maybe he could find out what they were all about, what they really wanted. "You know," said the original small gray man, "about these hostile forces. Your trouble here was really your defenses." "Cheap trash. But that's the Cyclos for you. They never put their money in good defenses. Personnel were cheap. They'd rather buy half a dozen new females or a ton or two of Kerbango than proper armaments." He looked at Johnny as though about to apprise him of something utterly devastating. "You know how much those anti-aircraft guns you use cost? Less than 5,000 credits. Cheap trash. They won't even shoot up to 200,000 feet. Bargain basement rummage sale armaments. They probably bought them from some war surplus, used. And some executive put the new price on the books and pocketed the difference." "What should a proper anti-aircraft gun cost?" said Johnny to keep it going. The newest small gray man thought a moment. Then he brought a small gray book out of his vest pocket and opened it. The page seemed to get bigger, and he scanned down it with a little reader glass. "Ah, here's one. Surface-space combination repulsion multi-computer firing defense cannon. Maximum range, 599 miles. 15,000 shots a minute. Simultaneous tracking of 130 vessels or 2,300 bombs. Destruction potential, A-13. That's capital ship penetration. Cost before discounts, 123,475 credits plus freight and installation. Now, batteries of those located around your strong points would have handled that entire combined force or kept them so high up they could not have launched atmosphere crafts." The original small gray man agreed. "Yes, that was the main trouble. The Cyclos were both improvident and credit-pinching at the same time. I don't think they even kept up this planet's defenses." Johnny could agree with that. He felt he was going to find out something about these fellows now that they were talking. Keep them talking. "Well, just at a guess," said Johnny, "what would you say proper defenses for this planet would cost?" He had started something. Both small gray men put their heads together. The original one started pulling all sorts of little things out of his pocket, looking into them and finding things. The newer arrival had a large ring on his left finger, and at first Johnny thought he was simply fiddling with it. Not so. He was twisting and tapping it with sudden little jerks, and a long thread, so thin as to be nearly invisible, was coiling out of the ring. They were very intense, and their voices murmured and blended together. 30 space probes, maintained carrier wave probe warning beams, 15 space drones automatic firing at all non-signal identified craft, cost of equipping terrestrial craft with identification beacons, 2,000 atmosphere beacons, 256 Mark 50 combat fighters, 400 flyaway anti-personnel tanks,
7,000 anti-personnel road barricades, 100 city cable defenses with retractable gates, 50 heat color search drones, 50 automatic target destroy surface drones.
They were finished. The newer one snapped off the thread at the ring and tapped it at the end. And with a little pop, the thread expanded into a long sheet of paper like a tape. He gave it a small flick, and it landed in front of the original small gray man. He picked it up, scanned the figures on it, and then looked at the end.
"With spare parts and freight," he said, "it comes to 500,962,878,431 credits at 2 parts in 11 annual interest rate, plus an estimated 285,006 credits annual military and maintenance personnel salaries, housing, and equipage."
He tossed the long tape across the table to Johnny and concluded,
"There it is, an efficient and economical planetary defense system. All top-of-the-line merchandise. Good for 100 years. That's the sort of thing you should have had. And you can still have it."
That was 498,960,878,431 credits more than Earth had. It had made him realize how broke Earth was. Now was the time to find out more about these two. "I surely appreciate your information. If you will excuse me, what are you two gentlemen, arms salesmen?" He might as well have dropped a bomb on them. They looked so startled. Then they looked at each other, and both of them laughed.
"Oh, I am so sorry," said the original small gray man. "It is so terribly impolite of us. You see, we are quite well known in our respective areas. And we know so much about you, in fact, know you so well, that it just never occurred to us that we never introduced ourselves. I am His Excellency Dries Glotten, and I am very pleased to meet you, Sir Lord Johnny Tyler."
Johnny shook his hand. It was a dry hand, quite rough.
"And this," said His Excellency, "is Lord Voraz. Lord Voraz, Sir Lord Johnny Tyler."
Johnny shook his dry, rough hand and said, "It is really just Johnny Tyler, Your Lordship. I have no titles."
"We choose to doubt that," said Lord Voraz.
His Excellency said, "Lord Voraz is the Central Director, Chief Executive Officer, and Overlord of the Galactic Bank." Johnny blinked, but bowed. Lord Voraz said,
"Dries here likes to call himself the Chief Collections Executive, but it is a sort of bank joke. He is actually the branch manager of the Galactic Bank for this sector. You might have noticed a time or two that I stepped on his toes accidentally. A branch manager has total authority for his sector and is a bit jealous of his prerogatives."
He laughed, teasing his junior.
"Your planet comes in his sector, and dealings about it are entirely up to him. He's the one who has to show a profit for his area. Now I am simply here because the emissaries have met. These are very troubled..."
Dries Glotten cut him off sharply.
"His Lordship can't be expected to know all the ins and outs of sector business. He does very well to keep up with universes."
Lord Voraz laughed again.
"Oh, dear. I am really sorry we worried you. Why, we have been looking..."
Dries cut him off again.
"We're just here to help, Sir Lord Johnny. By the way, would you like to start an account? A personal account?"
He was fishing in his pockets for the materials.
"We can give you a very low number and absolute confidence assured."
Suddenly, Johnny realized that he had no money. Not just no money in his pockets. He didn't have and never had had any money at all. He'd even given the gold coin away. He thought maybe he got pilot pay that was given to Chrissy, but he had never seen it. He steered off apprehensive thoughts of Chrissy quickly. He had better keep his mind on this talk. But he was broke, penniless. "I'm sorry," he said. "Perhaps later, if I ever get any money to deposit." The two gave each other a quick look, but Dries said,
"Well, just remember, we're not enemies of yours."
I think you would be very bad to have as enemies, said Johnny, still fishing. That fleet wouldn't go away until you talked to Snell.
Oh, that, said Dries Glotten. The Galactic Bank has lots of services for its customers. What you saw there was just notarial services. They needed a radio notary code trace to attest and verify that it was a valid conference order. He wouldn't take their word, of course. They trust the bank.
Was calling the emissaries here a bank service, too? Said Johnny.
Well, no, began Lord Voraz.
You could call it so if you like, said Dries, for sometimes such a conference is arranged as a service. It's in the interest of the Galactic Bank to have civilized planets do business together smoothly.
Johnny was not at all satisfied, but he put an easy face on it. These emissaries do seem to obey you, though. They call you Your Excellency, and they call Lord Voraz His Worship. What do you do if they don't obey you? You know, not come to the conference, or do what you say. The thought shocked Lord Voraz. Before Dries Glotten could stop him, he said,
Unthinkable. Why, the bank would call in their loans, shut off their credit, their economies would shatter, they would go bankrupt. Their whole planet could be sold right out from under them. Oh, they would think several times before...
Dries finally got his attention and shut him off.
Now, Your Worship, he said softly. I know you feel strongly about these matters, but we must remember that this is my sector, and things that concern this planet are my worry. Forgive me. I think possibly Sir Lord Johnny doesn't really know too much about the Galactic Bank. We haven't reprinted the information leaflets for ages. Would you like to know more about it, Sir Lord Johnny?
Johnny definitely would. He privately had become very alert about... the whole planet could be sold right out from under them. 4. Chang Wan poured more tea.
You mustn't get the impression we are violent people,
said Dries, taking a large swallow from a bowl.
Just powerful and deadly, Johnny thought.
Our race is called the Salachi, continued Dries. We are indigenous to the only three habitable planets of the Gridides system. The planets are mostly water, 9 surface parts of water to only 2 parts of land on the average, and we have only banking as our industry.
He smiled and drank more tea.
We're ideal bankers. We can eat anything, drink anything, breathe almost any atmosphere, live on almost any gravity. By tribal mores, we worship total honesty and the righteousness of obligation.
Johnny thought that was probably true, but he also thought they were not telling all they knew, and especially what they intended to do. Honesty might not include the whole truth, and there might be some real clues here as to what was going on. He smiled politely and listened closely.
We have about 5 billion inhabitants on each planet, continued Dries, and it is quite a busy population. Although mostly devoted to banking, we have, of course, our engineers and specialists, and, naturally, lots of mathematicians. Nearly 500,000 years ago, we developed spaceflight. That's about the right figure, isn't it, Your Worship?
Lord Voraz was still a bit out of sorts at the idea of planets going back on obligations, but he put a good professional banking face on it. 497,432 years this coming sidereal day, 103 for this universe, he said.
Thank you, said Dries, having gotten His Worship back into the discourse. And 302,000 years ago...
302,003, said Lord Voraz.
Thank you. We ran into the Cyclos. Now, don't be alarmed. We were not conquered. We didn't even fight a war. In those days, the Cyclos were not as bad as they became about 100,000 years later. In that time, they had not begun killing for the love of it. I'm sure I don't have to go on to you about Cyclos.
No, indeed, said Johnny.
This was all going somewhere that was going to wind up as bad news. He could feel it despite their smiles.
Precisely, said Dries. Where was I? Anyway, and this will amuse you. They were not interested in us, really, for we did not have any metals to amount to anything. Being mostly water, our planets would have presented formidable mining problems. We needed metals, and the Cyclos needed some computer technology we had, and so we became a market. This was something brand new in Cyclo experience. They had a lot to learn about finance and that sort of thing, so we taught them. Internally, they were pretty bad off. They breed like... what's some fish of this planet, you'd know? Like herrings. They have always been terrified of founding actual Cyclo colonies, for fear they'd rise and revolt against the home planet. They had mobs and unemployment, heavy, heavy depressions. They were an economic mess. So we helped them build markets for metals. With their teleportation shipping arrangements, it was very easy for them to do this. They became prosperous and developed even more ways to mine, and we saw to it they were economically stable. Then, suddenly, from the Cyclo viewpoint, an awful thing happened. It terrified them. That was about 200,000 years ago.
209,462, corrected Lord Voraz.
Thank you. Another race stole or invented teleportation.
The Boxnerds, Universe 6, said Lord Voraz.
It is unclear what happened then, said Dries. We don't always have access to military files, and we never had access to these, not ever. But I think the Boxnerds tried to put teleportation to military use. The Cyclos got there first, and the entire 7 planets of the Boxnerds, and every single Boxnerd, were wiped out. It took the Cyclos years.
3 years and 16 days, said Lord Voraz.
They even slaughtered people and races which had been associated with or allied with the Boxnerds, for we never afterwards found any trace of them. That war, said Dries, also seemed to change the Cyclos. For nearly half a century, they all but cut contact with other worlds. It was a bad time for us as well. Our economy was wrapped up in their concerns. They also must have engaged in some internal slaughter, because the next records we have show their own population to have decreased by 6/11. It took another century for the Cyclos to become busy again, but they were a very changed people.
Aha, thought Johnny. I have the time they began to use those capsules in baby Cyclos' heads. And why?
To protect their teleportation technology and mathematics. They had burned all their books, said Dries. They had lost any aesthetic arts they had had. You can tell from their dictionaries that the language they had accumulated over the ages ceased to be in full use. They dropped words like compassion or pity, and it even seemed they had dropped the term good sense. Although we refer to them now as Cyclos, that name didn't come into use until that time. Previously, they called themselves after whatever king might chance to be on the imperial throne. Anyway, not to bore you, for I see you know something of this. The ensuing centuries were very, very bad for everyone, especially the Cyclos. They built a reputation of being the cruelest, most sadistic oppressors any universe had ever seen. But they were in internal trouble. Their population was bursting. They were in economic chaos. They were 9 parts in 11 unemployed. The royal house was terrified of revolution, and as a matter of fact, experienced, I think, 4 assassinations of princes.
7, said Lord Voraz, and 2 queens.
Thank you, continued Dries. And in total desperation they came to the Gradiades and actually begged the Salachis for help. They wanted money to hire soldiers and buy arms. But our parliament, the creditable body, along with every other race in 16 universes, wanted nothing to do with them, and it looked like outright war. But somebody in the creditable body...
Lord Finister, said Lord Voraz.
Thank you. Had the good sense to turn them over to us. We were as big a bank then. The current head of it...
Lord Lunger, said Lord Voraz.
Thank you. Brought them to the bargaining table and really got them on the signature line. The bank would handle all economic connections they had with other races.
handle all transfers of Cyclo funds, handle all peace conferences. And in return, every Salachi would be held inviolate. The Salachi planets and the Gradides system were totally hands-off, and the Cyclos would furnish teleportation facilities throughout the universes for the bank. They signed. They got their money. They stabilized.
Lord Voraz spoke up. The only two times they ever sought to violate those agreements, they went into a nosedive splash and they hastily reformed at once.
So there, said Dries Glotten, you have the whole background of the Galactic Bank. We call it Galactic, you know, even though it should be Pan-Galactic, covering 16 universes as it does. But Galactic makes customers look on it as their galaxy's bank. More neighborly, don't you think?
What Johnny thought was that he was dealing with an outfit more powerful than the Cyclos. With the galactic organization that could give orders to monsters and be obeyed. He was very alert. There was trouble here somewhere.
Then possibly, said Johnny, you want to talk with the government here about teleportation service.
Dries and Lord Voraz looked at each other and then back at Johnny.
Not with the government, said Lord Voraz. I doubt it owns any of that. Teleportation would be quite another subject, and really we aren't engaged in having a talk to arrange a talk about it just now. You see, there is space travel. It is slow and time-consuming, but it does exist.
Johnny felt he was not saying everything, but he wouldn't push that. It evidently wasn't where the danger lay, for certainly it lay someplace. He could feel it. He sat easily and said,
Maybe it's about the payment of fees for this conference. They might be much larger than we had anticipated.
Oh, heavens no, scoffed Dries.
And he went to work with the ring he wore. The fingers flew. A thread came out and popped into an expanded tape, and he looked at it.
Negligible. The fees vary for emissaries because their governments vary in size and even pay them differently. But they only add up to about 85,000 credits. It could, of course, be more if they delay, but not much. The bank fee is standard, only 25,000 credits. There is, of course, the matter of my yacht.
The bank, said Lord Voraz, pays the space yacht expenses when he uses it on bank business. I think it would be fair, Dries, for you to charge up all the months you searched.
Dries cut him off sharply.
The yacht would only be charged from the Batafor planet of Baylor. That's the Galactic Bank branch office for this sector, he added for Johnny's benefit. It's a Hoven planet. They're not such bad people, really. Honest enough, individually. So call it 60,000 credits. The total is only around 170,000 credits.
They had that much, thought Johnny.
But Dries was hesitating.
We're not entirely sure yet that you would get this bill. It sort of depends on the outcome of the conference.
Something here, Johnny told himself. He was now getting a finger on it.
5. They looked at Johnny with their heavy-lidded eyes. They were very serious now.
His Excellency Dries Glotten leaned forward.
It's a question of clear title. The bank would never have anything to do with a clouded title.
Never, said Lord Voraz.
The whole reputation of the bank, indeed, the racial reputation of the Salachis, said Dries, is based on absolute honesty and impeccable legality.
Always legal, said Lord Voraz. It would be our ruin if we ever did anything illegal. We never bend rules. That's why uncounted quintillions of people trust us.
Johnny was not among those quintillions of people. There was something cold, hard, and horrible here.
Perhaps you had better explain further, said Johnny. If I'm to arrange a meeting for you, I really have to know the background of what will be taken up.
Dries leaned back.
Ah, well, that's true. Where shall I begin? Well, the point of discovery of this planet is a good place. The 16th universe, he continued, was the last one to be discovered, possibly less than 20,000 years ago, It was never wholly mapped. The Cyclo-Imperial government introduced probes into it to do further charting, but for a very long time they found nothing new. This planet is part of what might be called a rim star system, way out at the edge of a galaxy. It might have gone overlooked had it not sent out some probes of its own. It gave its exact location, an Imperial probe picked it up, and the rest is history. The Cyclo-Imperial government obtained title, quite valid, on the right of discovery, and this system's title was entered on the books for the first time. That government sold the planet to Intergalactic Mining, which, being short of cash, borrowed the purchase price from the Galactic Bank. All this is very routine, ordinary, and usual. Intergalactic Mining has done this countless times. Such loans are secured by lodging the deed of title of a planet with the Galactic Bank. The interest rate is usually 2 parts in 11. Or, in non-cycloarithmetic, roughly 18% per annum. The term was 2,500 years. Intergalactic in the past always paid such loans off smoothly. They knew better than not to. In fact, this was the only planet they had bought in recent times. All the others had been paid off. Such a transaction is called a mortgage. Are you following me so far? Johnny was. He had begun to guess what was coming. There was a second mortgage also, said His Excellency. It was to pay for the expenses of military conquest by Intergalactic. But that was a minor matter, and being at a higher interest rate, was paid off in only 5 years. Johnny got it. The Galactic Bank had financed the invasion of Earth, financed the gas drone. They must have detected that something had changed in his attitude. Lord Voraz said, "It is just business. The bank tends to banking, and the customers tend to their own affairs. It does not mean the bank was ever hostile to you. Actually, we are not hostile now. This is all just routine. Ordinary banking business."
"So, anyway," said Dries easily, not bothering to assert his prerogatives, "the basic mortgage has 1,400 years to run."
Johnny digested that, very warily, very alertly. "But I should think that a war and so on would tend to wipe out that mortgage."
"Oh, dear no," said Dries. "The simple fact of military takeover does not change the basic debt structure of a planet. That a government changes does not relieve the property of debt. Why, if that were true, then governments would just arrange to change hands every day, and they would be rid of all their financial obligations."
He laughed.
"No, no. A change of government or a military takeover does not change a country's debts. The new owners have to pay."
"The original conquest," said Johnny, "when Intergalactic took over Earth, did not assume any debts."
"They would have been internal," said Dries. "Internal debts have nothing to do with international debts. No, the planet was properly discovered, properly bought from the Cyclo-Imperial government by Intergalactic Mining. The mortgage papers were all properly executed. Everything was totally legal."
"Totally," said Lord Voraz.
"The debt is not in question," said Dries. "Who pays it is in question."
"You called this conference to see who pays the debt?" said Johnny.
"Not precisely, but close. You see," said Dries, "so long as combat was threatened and so long as one could not really determine who was and who would be the actual responsible government of this planet, I could not serve this paper."
He was holding a big legal-looking piece of paper. He did not hand it over. Johnny reached out his hand for it, but Dries said,
"No, you are not a member of the government by your own statement."
"What happens when you do serve it?"
"Why, we have a meeting to arrange the possibility in terms of payment, and if no agreement can be reached, we foreclose."
"And then what happens?" said Johnny.
"Why, the planet is put up for public auction and sold to the highest bidder."
Johnny began to understand the feeling he had had about these two. "And what happens to the planet's people?" said Johnny.
Why, that is up to the buyer, of course. The title would not be clouded in any way. He could do with them pretty much as he liked. That is wholly outside the province of the bank.